this is the start of another episode, of course, but this time we're going to do a break from our traditional format. We're going to just break it out and have sort of a long conversation about the year that was and the year that we're in and is upcoming. So we're going to be talking about 2006, some of the big things that happened in the industry and some of the big movies that were released. We're going to look ahead to next year, what's coming up, what are we excited about, and of course, by next year I mean this year, because we're getting started a little bit late in the middle of January, but a lot of good stuff to talk about. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and it is episode 17, because you forgot to mention that.
Oh, yeah, I did. Well, I'm just so excited about this discussion, because it's such an interesting break from our normal stuff.
Me too. Well, before we get into it, though, let me just remind everyone that the Oscar nominations were announced today. The winner of the nominations game in our little contest for the prize of a copy of the book Making Movies by Sidney Lumet will be announced on the site today. So if you go there, it'll probably already be there. If not, just wait an hour or two or something. And the second game is beginning today, where you predict the winners, and that'll be a second game, and we'll have more prizes for that one that we'll talk about next week. But even though this is recorded live, we need time to react and maybe digest the nominations before we comment on them.
Yeah, so if we act as though we don't know what's been nominated,
that's just an act. We're good.
We haven't had time to process it yet. This is being recorded live and distributed live. Whenever you listen to it is when we actually settle this. So if you listen to it like 3 years, it's still live. That's the way that it works. Anyway, so I think probably the first story from 2006 was the resolution, the 2006 Oscars, and the buzz that came around, because of course, since the Oscars are awarded, you know, in the next year, the Oscars that took place in 2006 were for 2005, and sort of going into it, the favorites kind of switched around, but there was a lot of buzz, a lot of real passionate buzz behind the film Brokeback Mountain, and a lot of people loved that movie. It had a lot of critical support, and a lot of people just thought, okay, this has to be the movie that's going to win, and then it didn't. Crash won it, a movie released in the summer, and that I don't think had quite as much, I don't know, there were certainly people loved it, obviously, it won Best Picture, but it didn't seem to have quite the buzz that Brokeback Mountain did.
Yeah, it had a lot of enthusiasm that was more under the radar and maybe not as shared across all the critical groups. And this does happen because although Brokeback Mountain's awards did extend beyond the critics' awards, it is not uncommon for a lot of critical unanimity to happen behind a movie that never even gets nominated for the Oscars. Think of Far From Heaven from 2002. It wasn't nominated, but definitely got all kinds of critical support. So, I don't know. The Academy is a different group of people, and it's allowed to make a different choice from a lot of other groups of people, and it just happened that the Oscars were the exception that year, I guess. Definitely Crash was my choice. I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I did too, and not to malign Brokeback Mountain in any way, but I think, like I mentioned earlier on the show, that some of it, there's a lot of controversy. A lot of people were really upset about the way this went down, even more so than in most years. There's always a little bit, but I there was this sort of idea that, well, the industry's being homophobic or something, and there were a lot of jokes in the media and stuff about Brokeback, that kind of thing, but I don't think that's the case. I just think it was a movie, it's sort of a quiet romance between two people. Those movies generally don't fare as well in the Oscars as do the bigger movies that have more of an epic feel to them. And so I think, sort of got into the political overtones, a lot of discussion about the politics of homosexuality and, modern society. And, I don't think it's fair to really look at this at all as any kind of referendum on the politics. Certainly Hollywood is not particularly conservative, and I think to accuse the members of the Academy for being homophobic just because they didn't embrace this movie so much, certainly it won some awards and it was nominated for a bunch. I don't know. I think a lot of that was really overblown and overhyped.
Yeah, definitely. And there were news articles about specific Academy members, one or two or something, that said, oh, I'm not going to see that. But, right. This is one or two people. They don't speak for almost 14,000 Academy members. And it doesn't help the author of the Brokeback Mountain novel, I guess, was really venomous about the Oscars. It's like she published this article afterward about how, the Oscars are so irrelevant and they don't matter and they stink and everything. It's like, well, why do you care what happened, the outcome? I don't know. It's just a very odd sort of situation. And I think a lot of people, Crash was a very divisive movie. Part of it was Brokeback Mountain lost, but part of it was Crash won. And I don't understand why it was so divisive, but I guess people didn't think it was very realistic and really got turned off by that. I think the point is that it's not realistic, but it touches on real themes. It uses the fairy tale format sort of to convey this. So I don't really understand what the big deal is about Crash.
I don't either. I mean, even if you didn't like it, some people will say, oh, it was the worst movie they'd seen all year. I can't fathom it. How can that be the worst movie of 2005?
That's crazy.
And so, you know, moving forward, one thing I want to talk about is I think 2006 was a real transitional year for the industry. We're going to see this throughout the year. You know, there's a lot of talk, and we'll get to this a little later, there's a lot of talk that 2005 there was a box office slump that, you know, people weren't going to see the movies as much as they were. You know, people were worried because DVD sales also had, for a long time, just been growing, you know, like gangbusters, and then kind of dropped off a little bit. And so people were worried, well, how is the industry going to make money? And there's a lot of talk about the internet and that kind of stuff, you know, downloading movies, and was piracy going to kill the movie industry? But I don't think the movie industry knows where it's transitioning to. There was a real feeling throughout all of 2006, I think, that things need to change, but no one could come up with how they had to change. We saw the release of the high-definition DVD formats and the sort of weird format war in the summer and the later parts of the year. The Blu-ray disc sort of backed by Sony and some other companies, and also the HD DVD format backed by some other companies and some other studios. And you know, these players are both really expensive, and they've sold out pretty early on, but I don't think yet there's been the same consumer embrace about them, because, you know, you spend $700 on a player and it only plays half the high-definition discs that are out there because the industry's fighting over them.
People are remembering the VHS versus Beta wars, and definitely that's what I'm thinking about.
I think so.
It's like, no way am I going to buy either one of these machines until one of them emerges as the dominant technology.
Right, and so, you know, the early ones, I think, sold out because there was this pent-up demand. You know, the home theater enthusiasts who have a lot of money to spend and want high-definition content really badly, you know, those are the people that are willing to go out and drop $700 on something that would be $300 in a year. So they were okay with it. I think this is why it explains sort of the initial success, but I don't think at all that they've had the sustained sales that you would expect them to, and I don't know that, you know, I think there's a real danger that maybe the public doesn't embrace high-definition DVD formats. No one really embraced Laserdisc. It was a successful medium in some sense. It stuck around for a while. A lot of movies got released, but it never had mainstream success the way DVDs or VHS had. And I don't know, is there a real compelling reason to move from DVD to high-definition DVD?
Yeah, it's a tough one because a lot of people don't really perceive a lot of differences in between the, you know, one resolution and another. You know,
right.
DVD gives you very obviously better definition than VHS, and even then, people, I'm not sure that was the selling point. I think the selling point was,
I don't think so either.
It was digital, it was a little disc, you don't rewind it, it's got a bunch of extras on it, and you know, you don't, it's, DVD is...
There are animated menus,
yeah,
chapter skipping.
Although that's annoying, but...
but well, I remember 1998 being blown away by animated menus. I was like, whoa!
Oh, please, no.
That was so cool the first time I saw them in the stores, just playing around. I'm like, whoa!
No.
I mean, the fact that you could jump to any scene you wanted to, that was
huge. Well, that was good. But the animated menus and stuff that annoyed me right from the first moment. But anyway,
okay, well,
whatever. The difference between DVD and high definition, either of the two formats, is going to be appreciated by cinephiles and videoholics or whatever the word is, and maybe not by a lot of other people who are quite happy with their DVDs. DVD fulfills the normal average person's needs, including mine, frankly. And
right.
I'm a cinephile. So...
Yeah, well... How many people just only buy DVDs when they're like $10 or less? I think that's part of the problem with the DVD these sales.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, of course they're going to drop off because I own a lot of movies, but I'm not buying them the way I was back in 2000 or 2001,
uh-huh.
whatever, because a lot of them are that I wanted, I have. You know, I waited forever for a good copy of Casablanca, and I have it. I don't need to buy it
yeah.
anymore. I waited for a long time for Citizen Kane. And I don't need to buy it anymore.
Well, let's clarify this, too, because DVD sales hasn't really dropped off. It's the acceleration, it's the growth
right.
that has dropped off. And, of course, that panics everybody else. And even though the acceleration of growth of DVD sales has dropped off, that's still a very profitable business and shows no sign of not being a very profitable business. But people are all panicky. I mean, in business, you base things on expectations. You don't really base things on reality. Making a profit isn't enough. In fact, you can make a loss and be successful if it wasn't as bad of a loss as it was. However that
right.
works. I mean, I guess expectations set stock prices, and that's a lot of it. But anyway, let's also talk about the slump in the same breath.
Okay.
The supposed slump of 2005. Everybody was very panicked about the drop-off of theatrical ticket sales. Theater revenues in 2005 dropped from the previous year for the first time in like 20 years, and that's making everybody all panicky, and we got article after article. It was so sick of reading about it, how the slump, and everybody's going to stop going to the theaters because they have iPods and they can watch a movie on an iPod or some kind of nonsense like that. In reality, 2005 was still the fourth highest grossing year for theatrical revenues of all time.
Right.
And even though, yes, it did drop off in the previous 20 years, it had all been steady growth. How long are you going to maintain growth like that?
Yeah.
The other thing is, in 2004, the previous year, there's a couple of anomalies that make the drop off from to 2005 really dramatic. And that is, two movies came out that pulled in huge amounts of audiences that don't normally go to the movies. And that would be The Passion of the Christ and Fahrenheit 9/11. Both those movies pulled in audiences that other movies would not have gotten. It's not like you can swap out X-Men for Superman and you get the same teenage kids trying to get a big blockbuster. These are people that don't go to the movies and they're suddenly going, and it just happened to fall in the same year, 2004. So if you remove the revenues for 2004 from these two movies, you get a 2005 that is still a little bit lower, but it's just the smallest, teeniest percentage. It's still a very still a decent comparison. And of course now in 2006 we're seeing an improvement over 2005, so whatever, it's an anomaly.
Yeah, and I also have to think, part of it's got to be that you can't keep growth up forever really in any industry, unless because really it's gonna be pretty tough to get the total number of attendance figures to rise. So a lot of that growth in the box office, I think, was really just, natural population growth combined with ticket price increase. Uh-huh. But I think ticket prices are probably pretty close to as high as they can get right now.
They're pretty stable at the moment, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they've, at least down here in Southern California, it seems like evening shows have been at $10 now for a while, or not quite $10, just below it, I think like $9.50 or something. But once you get to that $10 barrier, there's like a real psychological thing that kicks in, I think. I think if nationwide ticket averages start creeping up around there, it'll be harder for them to get over the $10 hurdle, so they can't keep going up. But yeah, and the whole download thing too. I mean, that everyone was like, well, it's because people are pirating movies. That was one of the things people were saying in 2005 that was causing the slump. That in 2006, we really saw sort of the large scale availability of movies to download over the internet. One of the big things was Apple's iTunes, which is the biggest of the online music resellers. They offered movies you could download. In addition, they already had TV shows, but they offered movies for sale. And people are like, oh well, that's gonna just take over. And I don't know that it's happened yet, because the movies that you download from iTunes, and there's a couple other video on demand services that existed before that would let you download movies, but iTunes sort of made the biggest news just because it's such a huge user base, and the iPod just dominates the portable video / portable music player market. So if you buy it from one of the other online services, you can't play it on your iPod. But I'm still curious, who exactly is going to watch a movie on the iPod? Unless like you're stuck on a bus or you're on an airplane, I can't really imagine that a ton of people are doing it.
No, and if we recall, we keep referencing episode 4. It's sort of a topic that keeps coming back as to whether the theater is the best place to watch a movie. And if just to recap, you basically say it's always or virtually always better to see a movie in the theater, and you try to see them all in the theater. And I'm more ambivalent about it. I definitely appreciate the theater, but see some problems. However, no way am I going to watch a movie on a 2-inch screen that I care about. It'll be maybe one that I've seen before, and yeah, I'm sitting on the bus, and there's no other convenient way to see it. Then, sure, I'll watch something on a 2-inch screen, but a movie I haven't seen before and I'm very familiar with, there's no way. There's no way. And I think, some people will, but I don't know that. I mean, it says something that television and home video did not kill the theater business.
Right.
It didn't. People are not going to stop going to the theater to see movies. And they're not going to stop now just because they can get it on an even smaller screen than the ones that were going to kill the theaters the first time.
Yeah, if anything, not to turn this into all movie talk plus a little TV talk again, but if anything, the iPod portable stuff, that's great for TV shows where you don't really care about the video quality as much, and most TV shows don't look very good anyway. Watching Seinfeld on your iPod is probably fine because all you really care about is the dialogue. You don't really need to look at the screen half the time. So, I mean, I think that makes sense. iTunes has a lot of TV shows. I think those have been a lot more successful than the movies, because even still, there's no good way to watch. Even if you download a movie on your computer, it's still not, there's no easy way to move it over to your TV set. And I know you can hook your computer up to your TV, but almost nobody is doing that. So don't tell me that's a good option right now. And so part of that goes along with, I think, another thing we saw, the day and date release versus theatrical exhibition. The reasoning is kind of funky, and it goes something like this. Look, since people are pirating our movies the day they come out, or even before the day they come out, and we make a lot of money off DVDs anyway, why don't we just go ahead and release the DVD the same day that the movie comes out? And we saw sort of a high-profile example of this year, the movie Bubble, directed by Steven Soderbergh, who is obviously a huge, big-name director, got released this way into some independent theaters and also on a DVD. And I don't think anyone really cared that much, aside from film industry analysts. Bubble's not a movie that's going to be seen on a big scale regardless. And so I think there was sort of a collective, when that came out. I think
people were saying, well, they saw the revenues for Bubble and they thought, well, I guess that kills that idea. But the reality is, Bubble wasn't going to make a lot of money. And yeah, it's a big name director, Steven Soderbergh, but he kind of bounces back and forth between the Ocean's 11 and 12 and these big movies and these really obscure, very independent, very limited interest kind of indie movies, and Bubble was one of these.
Yeah, I mean, how many of us went and saw Full Frontal in the theater?
Yeah, I know. And, Bubble was made by non-professional actors, and it was a story that wasn't particularly marketable at all, and so it wasn't going to make a lot of money anyway. So it's kind of actually unfortunate that they tried the experiment, you know, such a high-profile experiment with a movie that didn't have a lot of earnings potential. I want to see, you know, the next X-Men movie come out day and date and then see what happens.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I feel really like the industry is just trying stuff right now. You know, well, they're like, okay, fine, well, will you download movies? You know, obviously they've been really hesitant to do that, but I think they saw what happened to the music industry, and now that people have fast enough connection speeds, they can download movies. The movie industry doesn't want to, you know, have the movie Napster become the next big thing before they have legal ways of getting movies.
But, which is a good lesson to learn.
Yeah. But there doesn't really seem to be, I mean, people don't seem to be that interested in it just yet because, for lots of reasons. But movie industry is trying to change, but I don't know if it knows exactly where it's going. And the fact that they had this stupid format war with the HD DVD stuff, I think is sort of indicative of that. If that had been better planned, I think people would have been more willing to embrace the high def.
I think one reason that movie downloads aren't as catchy as music downloads is we take music with us wherever we go. You know, have an iPod and have 10,000 songs on it, and then no matter where you are, you can listen to it, and you just while you're doing whatever. You don't tend to do that with movies. You know, it's just like you know, you're driving to work and you want to watch a movie on the way, or you're at a you're at your desk and you want to watch a movie. You can't really do that. So people don't want to carry around 10,000 movies with them on their video iPods, even just to plug it into a computer and watch it on a slightly bigger screen. People don't want to do that. Instead, when they buy a movie, they want to have something physical, and the reason that music sort of beat that tendency for people to want to have a physical thing, it feels like you're getting more than when you just download a file. It feels like you own something.
Absolutely.
People want to have that feeling. Music beat it, though, because of the convenience of what you can do with music if you don't tie it to a physical medium. But movies, I don't think there's that advantage. So it was a good idea, though, because people are downloading movies illegally, so why not offer it legally at a reasonable price? And that will cut into the piracy, but it's not going to take over.
Right. And, you know, I mean, maybe eventually if we do get to the fact where we're actually watching movies on our computers that are hooked up to our TVs with Media Center PC kind of things, then maybe. Then I see it. Then I definitely see it. You know, if you give me and the real holy grail is like a subscription service. They have those for music. And I don't know, it's a little less convenient for music, I think, than just buying songs individually. But if you give me a subscription service where I can have all you can download movies, you know, onto my Media Center PC for $15 a month, I'm canceling Netflix.
Yeah.
If you have a good library.
If you have a good library, and if you have the whole plug your computer in your TV business, and we don't have that, and that's why all the people that predicted Netflix would be dead by now, or at least will in the next couple of years, because we'll all go to downloads, I think they're wrong. I think Netflix still has several years in them. It'll happen eventually. Right. It's just not going to be overnight. There's a lot of hardware you got to get out there, and a lot of inventory to build up, and infrastructure to put in place before you can replace Netflix, which is a fantastic service. If you don't have Netflix, and you're kind of wondering if you should try it or not, I mean, definitely worth trying. I love that company.
Yeah, especially if you're more interested in obscure films.
Great inventory,
Netflix is the way to go. So yeah, I mean, that's when I look at these video-on-demand services, and I see their catalogs, it's garbage. It's a couple hundred movies or something, and they're all pretty recent. There's stuff I can walk down to Blockbuster and get. What do I care?
It's like the high-definition thing. You made a joke earlier in the show somewhere, but you can see ultraviolet in high definition. It's like, you can download that. Oh, sure, great, thank you.
Yeah, I'm not that keen on doing it, and you know, you can't also just give me movies I already own on DVD. It's like, oh, I can download Goodfellas. Great. I've had that movie forever. I think there would be a market, though, for downloadable movies if you were to give me more obscure titles I can't find other places.
Sure, sure.
But the problem is right now Netflix owns that. Why would I cancel Netflix here? It's almost as good. You know, because you have to be Sam, really, in order to come up to the Netflix limit where you start, like, not feeling where they can't keep up with you. But if you're a normal person, Netflix is essentially infinite number of movies.
I want to know who gets the 8-at-a-time subscription on Netflix, because not even I could get through that.
Yeah, that's
I think even when I retire, I still won't get through that many.
So one of the things that I think helped this downloads, obviously, in terms of iTunes, which is owned by Apple, offering movie downloads, was a really interesting acquisition in January of 2006, and that was Disney bought Pixar. For a long time, Disney and Pixar sort of had a working relationship, and, you know, Disney distributed all the Pixar movies, and they had this deal, and they couldn't, when Eisner was still the head of Disney, they couldn't, like, renegotiate the contract, and so Pixar said, all right, fine, we're going to start finding a new distributor, we're going to talk to other companies, and it ended up happening that Disney, after Eisner got kicked off as CEO, Disney ended up just buying Pixar entirely, and it was a huge deal, just gigantic. And one of the interesting things it did is it made Steve Jobs, who is one of the guys who founded Pixar and owned a ton of stock in that company, it made him one of the largest Disney stockholders. And he's also the guy who runs Apple. He's the founder of Apple and its current CEO as well. And so now, I mean, Apple and Disney had this really close working relationship. And, of course, Apple is one of the pioneers in terms of the iPod and iTunes. And they even have a media center thing coming out in a little bit called the iTV. That's gonna be you know, way where you can stream movies that you've downloaded off iTunes to your television. It's a PC that already hooks up to your TV like a home entertainment device. So, you know, I think that kind of weird acquisition, and I think it's gonna mean something too for the future of Disney animation. Maybe you want to say a little bit more about that, Sam.
Well, yeah, I hadn't thought to say anything about it, but let's see. John Lasseter was the guy basically running the creative side of Pixar, and Disney not only bought Pixar and said, okay, you're going to be in charge of Pixar, he's also going to be the creative overseer of the Disney side as well, and so he's sort of coordinating both the in-house Disney animation unit and the Pixar animation unit as well. So maybe we'll... I don't know what'll happen, actually. We'll just kind of have to take a wait-and-see approach. Obviously, there's going to be an impact on Pixar, just the Pixar unit.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think Disney gets that they are best left alone because they are a working machine. They don't need the corporate to go in and interfere too much. I think that Pixar is going to be fine. The Disney in-house unit, at least potentially, could improve. I mean, I think Lasseter already canceled a couple of projects in, or at least postponed or put on the shelf a couple of projects that Disney had going. So maybe we won't see the, you know, the Chicken Little and I don't know what else Disney's put out. I mean, Disney has not been, it's so sad to see because they were the reigning animation movie kings for decades. For 50 years there were no competition, and then, you know, in the 90s they created competition by making animated movies so lucrative that people just had to get in on the thing, and then just suddenly, for some reason, I guess brain drain or you know, they wore themselves out, I don't know what happened, it just really plummeted and made movies that I actually don't think are that bad, but just not memorable. You don't care about them. Brother Bear, I saw that and it was kind of fun and not that fun. But so the potential, I suppose, is that the in-house Disney stuff could improve as well, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think the interesting thing about it is when the deal went down, a lot of people were saying, well, Disney paid Pixar a whole bunch of money to own Disney because they pretty much put Pixar people in charge of a lot of key positions in,
yeah,
Disney. Like I said, Steve Jobs is now he's on the Disney board, and he was the guy who was overseeing a lot of stuff for Pixar. I don't know. It's a good sign that Disney said, "Yo, please save us, Pixar," because Disney sort of had a crisis of leadership the year before with Michael Eisner leaving,
and
a lot of uncertainty, a lot of people on the board not happy with the way the company was going. So, I mean, Disney is such an important company in the film industry and is responsible for so many great films and has such a large library. It'd be nice to see them return to real creative success.
Yeah, but it's not just the people on top, of course. It's not just the management and the directors.
Right.
It's the animators as well that you know, are really important to have, and Pixar has them, and Disney does not, and I think it's because a lot of people left.
And part of it was apparently, you know, the Disney culture got to be a bad place,
right,
to be at creatively. You didn't want it. And so hopefully if that changes, you can, because, I mean, look, if you're a young animator, you want to go work for Disney because of its prestige and its history. That's some place, obviously, that I'm sure that anyone who's, you know, getting out of college now or in major in art and stuff grew up loving Disney movies. Who wouldn't want to go there if you're an animator or something right. like that, if it were a good place to work?
Yeah, yeah.
I know, I'm hopeful, and Pixar has just been so wonderful for the last decade.
Have you ever, I don't think there is a bad, not just movie, but even the shorts they produce, I don't think there's a bad one. It's really weird.
Yeah, Pixar is just brilliant, just everyone there, and you know, I mean, obviously Lasseter is a big part of it, but you know, there's movies that he didn't direct that are still great from Pixar. And
they did a great, it was a great move hiring Brad Bird.
Yes.
And this is the director of The Incredibles, one of Pixar's best movies, actually. And Brad Bird used to be a director outside. He did The Iron Giant, the 2D animated
Iron Giant for
Warner Brothers. And that was a very overlooked but very good animated movie. And they brought him on. They saw his talent. And they said, okay, you want to do a 3D movie for us? And he said, well, I've never worked in 3D. This would be fun. And he warmed up, and he made a lot of creative decisions that were really instrumental, I think. He was like, you know how computer animations get to the point where you can have really good detail with, you know, facial whiskers and, you know, wrinkles and all these kinds of skin textures that look kind of realistic. And he said, no, I don't want any of these. Just make them look like cartoon people, and we'll go from there. I think that was a really important decision for The Incredibles.
Yeah, I have to agree. So let's see, what else happened last year? The summer, there wasn't all that interesting in terms of summer movies, I didn't think. When thinking about this segment, I had trouble even thinking of any big movies.
A lot of them were underwhelming, yeah.
Yeah. One interesting battle we saw was the battle between Superman Returns, directed by Bryan Singer, and X-Men 3, directed by somebody who's completely unmemorable, Brett Ratner.
Well,
not exactly a great director.
Yeah, but he's done some okay movies before.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call any of them like particularly distinguished. You know, he didn't direct The Usual Suspects, is all I'm saying. Anyway, so Singer had directed the first two X-Men movies and wanted to direct the third, but he went and did Superman Returns, and Fox decided to move ahead without him, and so we sort of got this battle. Superman Returns came out right around the same time as X-Men 3, and X-Men 3, I think, was generally seen as the movie that performed better at the box office. I mean, it certainly made more money, and it didn't have nearly the huge, gigantic budget behind it that Returns did. Part of the budget problems for Superman Returns was that it had been in development for literally 100 years. They actually started its development back in 1906. It was going to be a series of silent films. It just got delayed and delayed and delayed. You know, everybody had taken a shot at the script, and I think everyone had been a director attached to it at some point in time. So
I think the version I had the most hope for would be the Preston Sturges version of Superman Returns. That would have been funny.
Yeah, it was going to
Superman falling over a lot, tripping over things.
He's going to have a lot of fun with the mistaken identity, the Clark Kent Superman alter ego stuff. Would have been great to see him tackle it, but alas. So Singer did it, and Superman Returns is actually a pretty good movie, and I think is actually better than X-Men 3, which is weird because I thought X-Men 2 was a great film, and I just thought X-Men 3 was kind of directionless and mediocre.
Yeah, X-3 was... I enjoyed X-3 quite a bit, but definitely if you compare it to the potential that the X-Men series had built up before that point, it's so disappointing. I mean, the whole business with Jean, I think, was just wonderful potential there for some real interesting psychological stuff going on. And the plot of X-Men 3 had just great potential to get in her head, and as she's doing this kind of psychological battle within her, and the movie X3 just doesn't touch upon that. I mean it touches upon it, but it doesn't get inside. It doesn't really make you feel what she's feeling. It just you're observing her behavior that doesn't necessarily make any sense at all, and maybe you can come up with intellectual reasons why maybe it does, but it just doesn't. And that, I think, was the key point of the movie that really didn't work and kind of made it just an okay entertainment thing, but very forgettable in comparison with X2, which was very psychologically realistic and compelling.
Yeah, unfortunately. And then maybe another story. I don't know how much I want to get into it. Just a little talk about one of the other big supposed summer movies was going to be Mission Impossible 3. And there's the whole Tom Cruise saga. Like, for the last, it seems like it's been forever that Tom Cruise has just been completely and totally crazy. But you know, Mission Impossible 3 didn't do as well as the studio had hoped. It didn't, you know, it didn't bomb by any means. It just didn't do as well as they had hoped. And a lot of people were saying, well, this is because Tom Cruise's craziness finally caught up with him. I'm not sure about that. I just think maybe people weren't interested in seeing a third Mission Impossible film.
I think the thing with Tom Cruise is, and boy, it's hard to make a judgment, you know, without really knowing the guy and to cut through all the media the ridiculous just overreactions to stuff with him. But I think he is kind of crazy, but maybe not in the way he's portrayed. But here's the thing, I think, that just if we speak professionally and not personally, because that's what interests me. I don't care about people's personal lives. Professionally, I think what happened is he acted in Eyes Wide Shut with Stanley Kubrick, and Kubrick is notorious, or was, for doing a lot of takes and being a perfectionist and doing retake after retake. He'll do 100 takes of one scene and not tell the actors what he wanted to do different. It was very famously, a lot of actors got frustrated. He says, I don't know what you want. Just tell me what you want and I'll do it. You know, so the actors end up just trying to do different things and hope that they get what Kubrick wants. And so that was his working style. For some reason, Tom Cruise really just clicked with this for whatever reason. He thought that was great, and he got involved in more than just the acting side. I think Kubrick opened his eyes to a lot of the things that you can see and control. I think Tom Cruise wants to direct, and so I don't know why he's not done it. But I think what happened with Mission Impossible is that he suddenly wanted to. This is something he, you know, series he produces. He wants to have that kind of Kubrick-esque control over the Mission Impossible movies and make everything perfect, and the potential directors for this series, I think, were a little put off by that, and so maybe the Mission Impossible series has just kind of gotten a little, I don't know, it's the production of them, I'm not saying the movies themselves, but the production of them has gotten kind of weird because of he wants to have extraordinary levels of control and perfectionism in how these are produced. It's weird.
Yeah, that is. It is kind of weird. But I don't know. I don't think Tom Cruise's career is over, I think.
Oh, no, definitely not. It's not over, no. No.
I mean, there's a lot of talk, well, you know, because he didn't get his production deal renewed at Paramount, and so people were saying, well, he's done with that. I don't think so. I think that's mainly for financial reasons more than anything else. I don't think a major movie studio is going to kill your contract just because they don't like you as a person.
Yeah, Cruise is not going away until he dies or retires, period.
Yeah,
because the fact is that even if 10 movies in a row bomb, he's more of a chance at success than an unknown.
Yeah.
And that's it, period. And there's always going to be somebody new that may be more attractive because, you know, they're the fad of the moment, or even if they're very popular, like Brad Pitt or Matt Damon or whatever, but there's only so many of these people. You can't get them all in every movie.
And, you know, I think there are maybe two people in the world who can really pull off, right, or at this point in time, who can really pull off like the movie star roles. And there's maybe Tom Cruise and George Clooney who can do it perfectly. There are a lot of other great actors. I'm not gonna say those are the best two, but when I want like a leading man for my action flick or something, I want one of those two guys because both of them are able to be like, I don't know. I think a lot of people rag on Tom Cruise. I think he's a pretty good actor.
Well, speaking of that, they rag on Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise.
George Clooney.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, that's true.
What kind of a name is Tom Cruise?
It's the ultimate movie star. Well, I mean, both of those two are just great at these sort of like traditional movie star leading man roles that don't necessarily require a ton of depth. But, you know, it's hard. You can't just plug anyone into those roles. You'd think you could because they don't require a ton of acting range. But, you know, when you try to put the wrong people in them, I think you get bad results. And those two are both great at those sorts of movies.
Yeah, you probably should add Will Smith to that, too.
Yeah, maybe.
No, I think so. I think he can do. He's the. You know, it's a personality that you're looking for in a leading man.
A certain charisma.
Action. Yeah, charisma, a personality, something that people click with, and I think people click with these three people on a huge level, and I think that causes a lot of other people to dislike them because of sort of their popularity and ubiquitousness. If you don't click, you don't want to see them in every movie. But definitely for box office and the you know, the crowds at large, they're going to click with these people.
And then a movie we saw sort of the tail end of the summer that we talk about maybe too much ubiquitousness, the movie Snakes on a Plane, which was the movie that the internet wrote and directed and was going to usher in a new wave of marketing, and if you've forgotten, how the heck could you? There was this movie called Snakes on a Plane that was in production, and people on the internet found out about its title and that it was going to have Samuel L. Jackson on it, and they went crazy. This is, you know, a lot of people just making fun of it and having fun with it because it's called Snakes on a Plane and it stars Samuel L. Jackson. How could you not make fun of it? I mean, good grief.
And this started almost a year before it came out.
Yeah, before anyone knew anything about the movie other than that there were going to be snakes on a plane that Samuel Jackson. So people started writing fake dialogue and making, there were like t-shirts and fake posters and, you know, just the internet thing. But by the time the movie actually came out, you know, it didn't really do that well. It didn't do terribly for a movie called Snakes on a Plane, or at least at the end of summer. You know, it made back its budget domestically, so that's really all you could really ask for. You know, it made like $34 million or so in the country, and that's not that bad. I'm sure it'll end up being a profitable film, but considering the amount of buzz that had it, because once the sort of mainstream media picked up on this internet buzz, it just spiraled ridiculously out of control. You didn't go anywhere without hearing about snakes on a plane, and became like the joke for 2006. But at the end, I don't know. I mean, I remember being kind of hyped up for it before it came out, a year before it came out. But then when I saw actual trailers for it, I realized that, in fact, I was going to have to watch an hour and a half of Samuel Jackson fighting snakes
on a plane.
That I actually didn't really want to sit through it that much.
Yeah, and the trailer was a real bad thing. There was no money shot in the trailer. You know,
yeah.
You get a, you know, the like in Superman, they almost made the same mistake in Superman Returns and not marketing a money shot in the trailers, and then they came out with the bullet hitting the eye. And
yeah, that was a pretty cool moment.
That was a good image. It came a bit too late, but that's a money shot. That's something where you see it in the trailer, and then it psychs you up for the whole movie, even if realistically you think about it, it's not going to be 2.5 hours of Superman getting shot in the eye with a bullet, and if it were, you wouldn't want it to be.
David Lynch would be directing it. It would be David Lynch Presents Superman.
Yeah, but Snakes on the Plane, you know, the trailer didn't really have a money shot, and there's all kinds of potential. I mean, the movie, the snake movie Anaconda, and I have to admit, I like that movie. It's a total garbage movie, but it has a few money shots in it, and
yeah,
that were, you know, just something that different that would show you. There's sort of haunting, and so if you accept that it's not going to be that great a movie, you can go watch it and enjoy it. And Snakes on a Plane didn't really have that. You need something to latch on to be the basis of why the fans like the movie.
Yeah.
And the trailer didn't have that. And I think the other thing is it should have been released back in February. People were sick of hearing about it by the time the movie came out, so why would they go see it?
Yeah, I mean, I probably agree with that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure anything would have really saved it, because once you actually saw the footage from the movie, I think you realized that was an actual movie and not just a joke, kind of some of its potential.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, do I really want to watch Samuel Jackson fight snakes on a plane? Yeah, for 10 minutes, not for 90 minutes. That's going to be a little too much, probably. And it looked like a kind of pseudo-serious thriller. That, I don't know. I wanted a more campy kind of look to it. I don't know.
Yeah.
So maybe we can talk about some movies later in the year, but I feel like we've talked about a lot of those because those are, you know, good movies. We talk about in the Oscar coverage, and we'll continue to talk about them. I don't have anything too much to say about anything that happened in the second half.
Yeah, I guess on either. If you are interested in the Oscars, I mean, we have covered them, and there's also more stuff on the website that's been posted there all along that breaks it down in more detail than you'd ever care for, but
Maybe from a business perspective, one thing that's interesting was the success of Borat, this weird movie based on an HBO show that only ran for 2 seasons, and also a character that was created over in England, but sort of obscure, just this weird guy going around and interacting with real people, that some of it's staged, some of it's not, and yet became a sort of mini phenomenon, made a lot of money and made pretty cheaply, and you know, I think that's going to be one of the movies that people remember. People certainly loved it, and a lot of people see it. I know, and almost people I work with and know personally just loved it, and people quote it all the time. So I think it's one of those sort of weird classics. I don't want to say the word classic, but sort of weird cult classic type movie.
We should note that it's an absolutely terrible taste. So if that's not your thing, don't see it. But
yeah, but I mean, that's part of the reason why
that's the reason why it's, well, this is certainly the reason why it has such a strong cult following. But, it was a strange thing to come out of nowhere, especially since there had already been a movie based on one of the other characters from that TV show. There was already a movie like that, and it didn't really take off at all.
All right. Well, part of that was that movie was just a completely and totally narrative-driven fictional film, I think.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the Ali G, the entire premise behind it is him interacting with actual people who aren't in on the joke.
Yeah.
And same thing with Borat. So I think the Borat movie is a pseudo-documentary, which lets it work, because that's half of the fun, is that not everyone in the movie is in on the joke. And then, of course, everyone ended up suing the movie for various and stupid reasons. Some of them not so stupid. Some of them, I think, might have actually had a case, but a lot of people apparently they didn't know exactly what they were signing when they signed away releases.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people weren't so happy with the way they were included in the movie.
And I think we've covered the Clint Eastwood Iwo Jima duology pretty well, but just a quick recap. It's worth a mention because it's just, I don't think it's really ever been done before. Two movies by director Clint Eastwood were released this year, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. And each movie takes the story of Iwo Jima from one of the sides. Flags of Our Fathers is from the American side, and Letters of Iwo Jima is in Japanese, starring Japanese people, and is from the Japanese perspective. And there's characters that overlap and events that overlap, but for the most part, they're independent from each other, except that they mirror each other. They kind of look at one battle from both sides. And I think that's one of the great things about movies, is the potential for portraying different perspectives in a compelling way. You can read a book to get the same thing, but how many people are going to? But you can go to a movie, and it's going to be much more immediate and emotional and visceral for you, so you can really get to an understanding of other people's perspectives if you go see a movie that gives you a different perspective. And so that's one of the neat things about Iwo Jima, these two Iwo Jima movies. It reminds me, actually, I don't know why, it's sort of a tangent, I'm not sure when it happened either, but actually I think it was this year. Steven Spielberg was going to do this project, and I'm not sure what the status of it is now. I really should look it up. But his plan was to give a bunch of movie cameras to a bunch of Palestinian kids, and then another bunch of cameras to a bunch of Jewish children. So they film home movies or whatever they want to film. They can just, their family eating dinner or whatever. Just film stuff. And then they swap cameras. They swap tapes and view each other's films. And I just think that's a great, just an interesting idea. And it really takes advantage of the potential of film to show you other perspectives. I think that those kids involved in that project, potentially anyway, could be quite benefited from it.
Yeah, either that or it becomes the biggest blowhard pretentious project of all time. One of the two. But an interesting idea. I can see how it could go either way, personally. So last thing I think we should discuss, that, you know, always one of those bad things in a given year, is the deaths that took place of famous people in the industry throughout the year.
Yeah, well, some people died, and it was really sad. And you know what's going to happen is we're going to watch the Oscars, and they have the necrology, and we're going to say, oh, we missed him.
Yeah.
But we should certainly start off by mentioning Robert Altman, one of the greatest of all directors. He was... We'll do a spotlight on him eventually anyway, I'm sure, in the show, but just a few comments about him. He was a bit older than the 70s generation of directors, but came about roughly the same time. His movies were sort of contemporaries of other people's, like Coppola's and Scorsese's and Woody Allen's and I don't know who else, Michael Cimino, and I don't know. There's a whole generation of directors that kind of cropped up all at once in the early 70s and started making these great independent-like movies with studio money, because the studios were open to that in those days. And Robert Altman has just been fantastic. I mean, he made a bunch of wonderful movies. Nashville, Shortcuts, The Player, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, MASH, of course. It's really sad to see him go. And his last movie was A Prairie Home Companion, released this past summer. And interestingly, it's about saying goodbye. It's about the ending of something. The ending of the show, A Prairie Home Companion, which is a radio variety show. Interestingly, though, the real show did not end. So I don't know why the movie is about this, but it's about the last broadcast of the show. And so it's about saying goodbye and things coming to a close and people moving on from big projects. And it's sort of, it's sort of interesting that this was Altman's last movie.
Right.
The end of an era.
And I remember watching that movie and just assuming that next year I'd get to go see another Altman movie, because the guy was pretty old, but he was constantly, like, a movie a year, like clockwork almost. It was always, you know, every year and a half, there's a new Altman movie out. And he didn't seem to be in bad health at all. He just made this film, and it was really weird to see him go. I never really thought about seeing Robert Altman go. It makes sense that he would eventually. But.
Well, speaking of 2006, at the Oscars in 2006 in March, you know, he was awarded an honorary Oscar for his work. He was one of these directors, along with several other great directors, that never won a competitive Oscar, despite being nominated 5 times. And finally they said, well, we'll give him an honorary Oscar. So good timing.
Yeah.
Good that you didn't put that one off. Well, some other people that passed away in 2006 that I have a particular affinity for, and I guess the two I particularly want to mention are, one is Don Knotts, an absolutely fantastic comedian. He was on, he was in a number of Disney movies like The Apple Dumpling Gang and stuff like that in the 70s, and he was on the show Three's Company, replacing the landlord on that show in midway through its run. And later in his career, he had a very interesting comic part in Pleasantville. And so he's been,
did you just mention Don Knotts' TV career without mentioning The Andy Griffith Show? His most famous role as Barney Fife, the deputy on The Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah, right. He was on that little show called The Andy Griffith Show, I think. But yeah, great comedian. Great comedian. I loved him as a kid and today as well. So, and he passed away. That was very sad. The other person, Shelley Winters. Fantastic actress. Very powerful presence. Especially in, the one I remember her most from was The Poseidon Adventures.
Yeah.
On a, not the remake, but the original movie. It was the best thing about the movie. It was, she had just this wonderful, wonderful presence. I mean, just being in the movie made it better than it ever should have been. Interesting actress. She did win an Oscar as well for a movie that escapes me. I'm going to go look it up while you talk some more.
Well, somebody else worth mentioning who passed away was Peter Boyle, the great character actor. His most famous role today is probably as playing the monster in Young Frankenstein, the Mel Brooks parody, or you probably also know him from television. He was the father on the sitcom Everyone Loves Raymond. You know, he sort of played this sort of sarcastic, cranky old guy, which is sort of a role he moved into. But, man, his performance as Frankenstein and Young Frankenstein is, I think, the best thing in any Mel Brooks movie ever. Just a hilariously comic performance, grunting and groaning.
And tap dancing.
And tap dancing. Tap dancing, too. Putting on the Ritz at the end of the film. And then, you know, getting angry when people take pictures. And what a great performance. And just one of those guys who, you know, never really a big leading man, but showed up in all sorts of movies playing a huge variety of characters, one of those, you know, the so-called character actors, where you see him and maybe not everyone recognizes his name, but they'll know his face and his voice as soon as they see him.
Right.
Sad to see those sorts of people go, too.
Yeah, I first sort of came to know him from The Dream Team, sort of an ensemble comedy about a bunch of... It's like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but done as a comedy. Not the same story, but the same idea, where you have people in a mental hospital that go out on the town in New York on an excursion, and the doctor who's supervising them kind of gets separated, shall we say. And so they're off on their own devices, and he just plays one of the four people, and it's very good in that. If you go to our website, allmovietalk.com, we do actually have a write-up, a thread on him. Just search for Peter Boyle in the search box, and you'll find it. I looked up Shelley Winters. She's been nominated four times. Probably the two that she won for, she's less famous for than the other two, but she won for the supporting roles in The Diary of Anne Frank, the 1959 film, and also A Patch of Blue, the 1965 film. But she's probably better known for The Poseidon Adventure that I mentioned that she was nominated for but didn't win, and also the 1951 film A Place in the Sun. And so now you know all about Shelley Winters and her awards. A few other people. Chris Penn, Sean Penn's younger brother, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, he died rather prematurely, and he's sort of the quieter brother. You know, he's not full of the bluster and the, dare I say, pretentiousness that Sean Penn, I think, has. It kind of turns me off him. But Chris Penn was another one of these character actors that you like to see. And also Jack Warden, same sort of situation. He was actually a lead on the TV show Crazy Like a Fox, but he played in a number of movies as sort of character supporting actors. And like you say, they're fun faces. It's like a movie family, you know. You watch a movie, and it's maybe like a family reunion where you see some familiar faces that you'd forgotten about, but you like. And so it's always a pleasant surprise. You always know when Tom Cruise is in a movie, but you might not always know when Jack Warden's in a movie. And,
right.
And when you see him, that's a pleasant surprise. I think that's one of the things. And Maureen Stapleton is another character actress that passed away this year. She made the movie Interiors by Woody Allen is one of the things I remember her from. But a lot of unfortunate things. And of course, there's the big one. And it does tie into movies a little bit. But Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, was killed doing what he loved by I'm sorry, I have to laugh, even though it's a terrible thing, but he was killed by one of the least dangerous creatures in the world, which was a stingray. You tend not to get killed by stingrays, despite the name, but gosh, I always thought, I mean, he would always be saying, now, dangling from my finger is the most dangerous snake in the world.
Right.
It's just, how did he die that way? But at least he was doing what he loved. And he was in the movie, what was it called, Collision Course or something? And
yeah, the Crocodile Hunter movie.
That was very cheesy, but I actually liked it. I mean, it was kind of fun. It's all based on Steve Irwin's personality. So if you like him, you know, whatever, you like whatever he's doing.
Sure. And we also, of course, lost the hardest working man in show business on Christmas Day, James Brown. Not really, he pops up in a surprising number of movies, but also just a guy who provided so many songs, so many soundtracks throughout the years. How many movies feature I Feel Good at some point in time? And of course, provided one of the great songs in the Rocky movies, the song Living in America, written for Rocky III. And great performer, entertainer. And again, I guarantee that in the next year, at least one or two movies will be released that have James Brown songs in them that would have been released regardless whether or not he had died, just constantly being used in the movies. So I think that pretty much wraps up our discussion of 2006. If there's anything we missed, feel free to jump over to our website.
I'm sure something happened in 2006 that we didn't talk about.
Right, but anything that you want to mention that didn't happen, allmovietalk.com, and I think we'll be rejoining you in just a second to discuss what's upcoming for 2007.
So we'll look forward to 2007, and Stephen, what are you looking forward most to? If you can pick one movie.
I'm looking forward to Grindhouse.
I said one movie, Stephen.
Oh,
one movie.
You got me. Okay, well then I'll take the Quentin Tarantino segment from Grindhouse, whatever it's going to be called, the slasher flick starring Snake Plissken as the killer.
And
I think that looks pretty good.
Just to tell you what this is sort of a double feature. The two films, full-length films, I guess, one by Tarantino, one by Robert Rodriguez, and they're packaged together as one film called Grindhouse, and it's supposed to be this sort of simulate the 70s double feature drive-in kind of thing, and there's a bunch of crazy over-the-top horror comedy kind of...
Who knows?
I don't know. It looks like complete nonsense to me, but I don't know.
All I know is that when Quentin Tarantino tried to do his take on the 70s Kung Fu Chop Saki movies, we got Kill Bill Parts 1 and 2, these like grand operatic takes on Kung Fu with lots of great music. And I don't know. I would never have predicted that Kill Bill would have been the movie that it was. So I'm just looking forward to Grindhouse.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily looking forward to most of these at all, but one of the interesting stories we always get every year, it seems, is like how many sequels are we going to get this year? And I think the story now is that, 2005 surprisingly didn't have that many, but 2006 is loaded with them. That's not true. If you actually count the numbers, there's just as many as there's always been. It's sort of an increasing number of sequels and remakes as we go. From year to year, and I've actually tracked this on the Rinkworks website for a couple of years, not every year, but it's sort of interesting just to list them all, just go through all the movies that are scheduled to come out in the following year and find out which ones are remakes and sequels, and there's just an astonishing number. Of course, some of them won't actually get released in this year. Maybe some will be canceled and others will be postponed, but for now, this is what it looks like. I'll start with, there's a few TV show movies based on TV shows. One is Babylon 5, The Lost Tales, Voices in the Dark. That's a direct-to-DVD. A couple other direct-to-DVDs are Star Trek World Enough in Time, which has the original series characters at a younger age, I guess. Teen Titans, Trouble in Tokyo, and then theatrical releases Reno 911 Miami, Robotech The Shadow Chronicles, The Simpsons Movie, and Underdog. We're going to have a full-screen treatment of Underdog, I guess. For remakes, we've got The Eye, the remake of the Japanese horror movie.
Oh, boy, another Japanese horror movie remake?
Yeah, isn't that exciting?
Boy, I can't contain my excitement. I think all three people that saw Pulse will be lining up to see that one.
Yes. And we're also getting another version of Fahrenheit 451, another version of The Heartbreak Kid, another version of The Hitcher, a fifth adaptation of the book I Am Legend, and the first one to use the book's title. A remake of a French film, I Think I Love My Wife. The Invasion, this is the fourth screen adaptation of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Got another version of Nancy Drew, another version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, this time is 3D animation. 310 to Yuma, and The Transformers, a big Michael Bay thing of The Transformers, and Zodiac, David Fincher's remake of The Zodiac Killer. So a bunch of remakes, and my favorite here, a remake, not a sequel, of Halloween. And this would be Rob Zombie remaking Halloween. Sounds like a nightmare to me. Maybe that's the point. I don't know.
Interesting. That's an interesting person to direct that film, though. I don't... Oh, that's...
Interesting is a word.
That's an inspired choice. I kind of want to see it now.
I think unwatchable is more the appropriate word.
Maybe.
But...
Is it gonna be about Michael Myers just like torturing people to death, or...?
I don't know. I don't want to think about it, Stephen.
I'm intrigued now, I gotta say.
I also don't want to think about most of these sequels. I divided these sequels up, and we'll start with the Terrible Twos. This is the part two of a series. Sequels to Alien vs. Predator. We're going to have Alien vs. Predator 2. And we're also going to have another Perfect Stranger. You probably didn't even know the first Perfect Stranger movie came out. We'll get
What is Perfect Stranger? Is that show with Cousin Palky and Cousin Larry?
Yeah, no, but it should be. That would make it better. We got Are We Done Yet? A sequel to Are We There Yet? And also simultaneously a remake of the 1948 comedy Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House's sequel remake combo 1-2 punch there.
Wait, Are We Done Yet is a remake of Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House?
Yes,
but wasn't that already remade as The Money Pit?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
That's
okay,
true.
Interesting.
We got Evan Almighty because, you know. If you do a sequel to a Jim Carrey movie without Jim Carrey, it's a proven box office rule that it's just a smash hit. And so you want to do as many of those as you can. We got the Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. We'll just combine a few superheroes there. We got Fear of Clowns 2, direct-to-DVD. We got The Golden Age, which is a sequel to Elizabeth from 1998. Not an obvious candidate for a sequel, but actually quite intriguing. The Hills Have Eyes 2 and Hostel Part 2, because we always got to do sequels to horror movies, such as also Open Water 2. And we'll, of course, bring back Mr. Bean for Mr. Bean's Holiday and do National Treasure, The Book of Secrets, and 28 Weeks Later, of course, the sequel to 28 Days Later, which was not the sequel to the Sandra Bullock film 28 Days. And 2001 Maniac's Beverly Hellbillies. An Undisputed 2 Last Man Standing, direct-to-DVD. So those are your terrible two sequels. Moving on to threes. The threes are really interesting. They're high-profile stuff. And in May of 2007 alone, we're going to get Shrek 3, Spider-Man 3, and Pirates of the Caribbean 3.
Oh, man.
I mean, wow, box office records. I mean, the first two of each of these series made a combined worldwide gross of $5 billion.
Wow.
So I think it's pretty much going to be a record May, probably a record summer.
Can I say something about Spider-Man 3?
Yeah.
I didn't like the first two Spider-Man movies, but the Spider-Man 3 trailer looks pretty good. I don't know. I'm thinking that maybe that'll be a good movie, but I feel like I got suckered in the first two times, and I don't want to get fooled the third time, but that trailer makes it look like the movie's actually about something. It looks intriguing.
Yeah, but
except for the guy who's made of sand. That looks pretty stupid.
I kind of agree with you, but this was also pointed out on the All Movie Talk website, but the Spider-Man series is mirroring Superman, and that's not a good thing, because Superman 3 was also about Superman kind of battling with the dark side of himself, and that was not a good movie.
That's true.
All right, so anyway, also high-profile Part 3 is The Bourne Ultimatum and Resident Evil Extinction and Ocean's 13 and Rush Hour 3. Big time summer, and also the direct-to-DVD Cinderella 3, A Twist in Time. I'm really sick of Disney releasing direct-to-video animated sequels.
So wait, are they releasing Ocean's 13 in the summer? Because it was a holiday release the first two times.
Yeah, it's the summer this time.
Interesting. Are they going to actually include any heists in this one?
I hope so.
Because it was kind of lacking from Ocean's 12.
I hope so. Fours, not so many, but of course we'll have Saw 4, because we got to make one of those every 4 months because they make a lot of money. And direct-to-DVD Pumpkinhead Blood Feud. What is it about horror movies, Stephen, that just spawn these huge series? It's just that they're cheap to make and make a lot of money.
I think so. There's like a market for them, because, you know, they're aimed at 17-year-olds who haven't seen any other horror movies. So it's fine if there's like any name recognition at all at the local Blockbuster, they'll get some rentals.
But how can there be a market for all of them? There's 1,000 of them released every day.
Yeah, it seems that way. But don't forget, you know, you got to go see a movie at Halloween, and you know, got to go see a scary movie. So time for another Saw flick.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Also, they're really cheap to make. It's worth pointing out. It's like $10 and some ketchup gets you a horror movie.
Well, the part four I am looking forward to a lot is Live Free or Die Hard.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Best
you know, I'm looking
title.
Forward to that.
It's the best title of any movie ever made.
Since Die Harder, maybe.
No. Live Free or Die Hard. That is the Live Free or Die is the state motto of New Hampshire, and I'm from New Hampshire, and that has something to do with it. But still, Live Free or Die Hard.
Yeah, that's true. I'm excited.
It's a fantastic
I'm excited for that flick.
Yeah, well, there's a few part fives as well, or a couple. Hannibal Rising. We got to do another Hannibal movie because those make a lot of money. Also, this time without Anthony Hopkins, though, so I'm not sure. It's a sort of a prequel, get a younger guy and play the role. And then the big one, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, coming out in the summer this time, sort of alternating between Thanksgiving and summer with these movies. Definitely looking forward to that. They haven't done a bad one of those yet. They don't hold a candle to the books. The books are fantastic, especially once you hit part three, the books really start taking off. But the movies have all been, I think, fantastic. And then from there, we jump up to a part eight. And even then, it's a bit higher than that. It's Godzilla versus Deathla.
Deathla?
Deathla is a great name. Good. Deathla. Yeah, this is the eighth in the series, but it's the eighth in the third Godzilla series, so it's complicated. There's been many, many of those movies. And finally, we have a part 12. Of course, we have The Land Before Time 12, The Great Day of the Flyers, direct-to-DVD. Gosh.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. Ah, so, you know, some of those movies actually have me pretty excited.
About a third of them I'm quite intrigued by, especially the summer movies. I think we're going to see at least a box office boom in the summer.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of those movies have the chance of being good, too.
It's pretty surprising for, especially when we get there's some good-looking movies in Part 3, you know. Ocean's 13 could be a really good movie if it works out, and maybe Spider-Man 3, I don't know. But, you know, usually by the time a series gets to 3, it's kind of dead. Maybe not. Well, I guess that was the year that was, and also the year that will be, so that pretty much wraps us up for this week, but plenty of discussion on our website, allmovietalk.com. A big shout-out to everyone who goes there and participates in the discussion. I've really been impressed by how interesting a lot of the conversation has been, and sort of all over the map in terms of we talk about, you know, French flicks one week and then an in-depth debate over the Rocky series the next. A lot of fun. So be sure to check it out, allmovietalk.com.
And also check out rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com, in particular to see the results of the Academy Awards predictions game, and we'll get another one going, and we'll talk to you about that, as well as give you our reactions to the nominations next week in episode 18 for January 30th. And we will finally get back to wrapping up our series on sound. And our top six list is going to be movies that play with time, but not time travel movies. So that'll be interesting. Maybe think about what your own picks for that category is before we get to it, and then we'll see how we line up when we get there.
Cut! Okay, let's do it one more time, and this time with feeling.